Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're covering Season 1, Episode 10, titled The Leap. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
I really like this episode. It's funny because, like, with, like, 10 minutes to go, I was feeling like, yeah, I can see how they're going to hand this thing off from the show to the book and kind of keep the general plot going. And, you know, Goyer's always said that this is going to, you know, with the Salver we meet in the books is much more seasoned and, you know, this isn't the Salver, this is her origin story. And I'm like, okay, well, now we're going to season two. She's going to be the mayor of Terminus. Right back on track. And then they threw a wicked curveball.
Wow.
Which, like, and now that's the thing. It's like, I like a big swing like that. And it's weird because, like, it reminds me of, like, what Vince Gilligan said, that, like, at the end of the season, they always like to give themselves, like, you know, paint themselves in a corner as a creative exercise. I don't think that's what Goyer's doing, because it seems like he has, like, a rough, or maybe not so rough, outline of the next 7 or 8 seasons, right?
Yeah.
But it feels to me, like, this to me feels like a paint in the corner. Like, what the hell are you going to do? Also, like, I was really, like, some of the things about, like, how fucked the Empire is from, like, a genetic dynasty was kind of, like, a real kind of thrilling shock to me. Some of the Imperial stuff was real strong this week. Let's put it
for
that
sure.
way.
I agree. I think this is a pretty amazing episode. I saw all those rails that we were getting back onto. I'm like, okay, we've got 500 years of Empire, you know, this, it can't all derail in a span of like 30 years. So we're going to need a lot more. And then they started to derail it. And I'm seeing trains go off of lines and roll over onto their sides. And then, you know, Demerzel violently brings it back onto the rails. You know, she Supermans it back onto the rails. It's crazy. And then the stuff with Salvor, this is like a burning your ships behind you moment for her. And now they're both kind of stuck here. I guess Salvor would have a ship maybe in orbit, just kind of floating around her ship.
Maybe.
But she said something about crash landing.
I think the beggar, like, I think that that's what the beggar is lying at the bottom of the ocean. Now, I don't know. Maybe this is a Star Wars situation where, like, you can have an X-Wing sitting underneath the waves for 30 years and, you know, you can just get it out because, like, that's how fucking good material science is now. No rusting, no decay. But that might be, like, I am over second guessing this show's technology, man.
Oh, yeah. Like,
That Harry Chrysalis at the beginning of the episode, like, I started to be like, what the? And I'm like, you know what? Nanobots and 30,000 years of human advancement. Sure. They're operating on science I can't even understand. So
indistinguishable from magic. Sure. I love it. It's just wild to see things not go the way I thought they were going to go and being set up so well. And I'm also, you know, a big fan of what they did with, like, Salvor and Hugo in this. I actually like their relationship quite a bit, right? It's like they obviously care about each other a lot, but they're willing to say, hey, you got to be you and I got to be me. And they're sort of ships passing in the night in a way.
I will say that Hugo is mature. I was shocked. I was shocked at Salvor pulling the, like, good, like, what essentially becomes goodbye forever. I don't know. Uh-huh. Like, maybe she'll have some adventures in between her, but she's not, like, she doesn't spend like 20, 30 years before she gets into that time capsule. Like, she's recognizably the same person. So, like, yeah, like, you know, Hugo's, I mean, I don't know what kind of relationship they had, but, like, it's pretty shitty to just ghost somebody.
Yeah.
Especially when you're stealing their ship, too, on top of that.
She does not handle that very well. It's once they get together, Hugo, it's like, yeah.
Especially since Hugo could handle it, like, clearly was not going to, like, do the whole, like, oh my God, please, will you not? And he's had a couple of opportunities to be a stand-up guy this whole thing. I thought it was a little shitty that she didn't trust him yeah. apparently.
Maybe I'm viewing it from his
side.
Or
was afraid of the emotional confrontation.
For sure. Yeah, I understand why she might be, but also, yeah, that does suck. But I don't know. Those scenes where, you know, they both get teary-eyed. They've had a couple now when she was leaving the Invictus, I guess. Yeah, those have been good scenes. I've enjoyed those. Mm-hmm. But man, not as much as I enjoyed the Empire stuff in season one. It's been so good.
Empire has, I mean, it's great because like it's a great villain, and I think if I have understood Goyer right, that they're intended to be kind of the antagonist for a large part of the series. Mm. And I start thinking about like. Because like you, like I thought they're going off the rails and then Demerzel put them back on with the Hands of Steel. But then they kind of blow it up again. And I'm like, what's this look like 3 seasons from now? Like Lee Pace with like a hunchback or 3 arms or, you know, how will they continue? Because right now the rot is on the inside, right? It's just right. Like, yeah, you're. You've got these like slightly elusive things different. You got some missing rods or cones in your eyes. It's all that. But like once a genetic drift starts drifting and you don't have any sample to like return to baseline, what does that look like?
Yeah. I feel like they need to disintegrate Dusk when he inevitably becomes Brother Darkness. They probably need to maybe freeze him in a little carbonite. Start taking
that's
some
the big that's. That's one of the big cliffhangers, right? That like they toss that ball in the air. Is Dusk compromised too? I guess I would think that he is, but
We don't know. He seems to be, you know, the one who's most Empire right now. If you kind of compare him to what the original vision for this Empire, this legacy was.
Yeah, he's the most Imperial Empire for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but he also made a crucial error with the Anacreons, right? That played right into Harry's hands. So who knows? But maybe it's going to be really interesting next season.
The thing is like maybe they're suggesting that Day is drifted and that's why. Because like I think maybe there's room to interpret like if Empire had continued to be as dominant and like just straightforward confrontational as Dusk is, that they wouldn't have these problems. I think that's Dusk's opinion. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, like what the fuck, man, you show up on the Maiden with like a fleet of warships and you bomb half the planet. Like,
yeah,
I don't think that's going to solve. Like, yeah, I think you're running to the end of like what force can get you. And that's what's so interesting because they're remixing this the very concepts of psychohistory and what Foundation is all about to the point that like is it inevitable or is Harry a revolutionary? He's just like this is
yeah.
like is the Empire going to fall or is he just like I've looked at psychohistory and I see the galaxy go into this like fascist hellhole and I'm not having it mm-hmm. like and my way of revolting is like creating some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that then I can guide into which
yeah
let that's it fall. A lot more megalomaniacal I think than even Harry Seldon is from the books, which is saying a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've only read that first book, so I don't know how far that goes, like what was his intention originally. I do know from the book that the Encyclopedia Galactica is a thing because it's read from frequently during that book. And so mm-hmm. one of their goals seemed to have been to catalog information, but also I haven't read much more. So we'll see. I suggest we get into the recap.
Let's do it.
But let's take a break first.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Thank you.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
All right, Harry's coffin turns into the vault. And his body. That's the description of this scene. While Gail sort of talks over with her monologues about leaps and how going to sleep is a leap of faith. Our souls wander when we dream. They'll eventually find their way back before we wake, if we're lucky, I suppose. Leaving the cradle is a leap. Going into space, essentially, is a leap. All of these visions we're seeing as she's talking about the different leaps people make.
It's cool. It also serves as a non-opener, you know, like they've eschewed the title sequence and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, instead they have this kind of like poetic thing and Harry's coffin turning into a chrysalis, which was more accurate than I would have thought, like in the first right? 5 minutes of this episode. And then like, you know, they get this, there's so much beautiful space porn in this episode. This episode also written and directed by David S. Goyer. Like, nice. Took the helm, took the typewriter, did the, you know, he probably say that's, you know, it's still a group effort, but yeah. He's the guy on all the title cards this episode. And our man went for broke on the space porn.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, so much beautiful space porn. Like the coffin being launched from the Deliverance, the rings of Synax. Yeah. The beggar leaving Terminus later, flying, you know, doing the flyby past the Invictus. Like, there is just lovely, lovely, beautiful shots.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, so like great eye for that spaceborne. I liked it a lot, and this was one of the prime examples of it.
Yeah. Another thing I thought looked really cool was Harry's body and coffin being disintegrated and turned into the vault. That's kind of a moment. It's almost on par with something I would have seen in like 2001. Mm-hmm. Just the feeling you get watching that with the music going and just the creation. Like we had speculated, I guess, like, oh, maybe because I pointed out at one point, like the vault that they put Harry in looks kind of shaped. He's kind of shaped like the coffin.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or that coffin is shaped like the vault. And so it turns out that actually did turn into the vault. I thought that was kind of cool. And then I guess there's a physical Harry that can be manifested from that. Because he was not, as best I can tell, a hologram.
Well, the kid touched him and he was clear. Like, they had the kid... Right, like that's right. Like me doubting Thomas putting his fingers in Jesus' side. Like, no, he's a hologram. maybe a sticky hologram, but he's definitely a hologram.
Okay.
But I think you're onto something there. Like, if you have a machine that broke something down by the molecule and turned it into another form, and mm-hmm. also stripped the consciousness and stored it in a way that can retain sentience, I don't understand why you couldn't reverse that process eventually.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard. And they do say it's like, harder to build than to destroy, but yes, I would think
true.
You could do it.
And the vault, you know, Goyer was joking about this with Jason Concepcion last episode of the official podcast. So, like, you know, what's there left in the vault? Oh, it's an ice cream parlor. It's this, it's that. But like, I do feel like there's something left in the vault, because it is doing a whole hell of a lot for just generating, you know, just manifesting Harry's consciousness.
Yeah.
And then soon as it was done, it, like, you know, enveloped back up, and it's presumably putting out the null field again. I thought that was, you know, there's a lot of answers we got that were surprisingly satisfying about, like, why all this was happening.
Yeah, for sure. Questions we've been asking for episodes now.
100%.
Finally getting answered. All right, so Harry steps out, obviously, of the vault, and we kind of pick up where we were last episode. And he tells the Anacreons and the Thespians that the history that made them enemies ages ago is actually a lie, and it was, in fact, Cleon II that caused the event that created that lie, because he saw that the Outer Reach was becoming powerful, and he wanted to disrupt that. They're skeptical, but they hear him out, and then Harry finds out that Gale never made it to Terminus, and is introduced to Salvor. And Harry suggests they use Terminus knowledge to build more ships like Invictus, which shocks everyone, because they didn't think they were a revolutionary group. They thought they were just an information preservation group.
Harry kind of lied, so that was a lie. I think that the show puts a little bit of faith in the audience that because this is a very sudden injection of information that I think like this. I don't think this plays out very realistically. Like, you know, that, like, this hot, like, in the middle of them about ready to annihilate each other, this weird hologram steps out from a guy who, like, they have kind of antipathy for, because he's at the center of, like, what caused their, like, the Anacreons, at least, cataclysm. And he starts just saying, like, here's alternative facts. Mm-hmm. You know, you think, and you've been thinking this for almost 400 years, the actual, I wish that they, that Harry had some kind of chip or something where it's like, this is the Handmaid's Confession, and here's how you can authenticate it. And I've, you know, because I'll believe that Harry can do a shit ton of research like he does with the Invictus and stuff like that, because he's got funds and he's essentially psychohistory Batman. But, like, I felt like they needed something beyond the hologram's word, especially since the hologram fucks off 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
And it's like, you guys got all this.
And especially because last episode they're talking about, you know, something that Harry points out to them is the Victor's right to history, right? Like, he could be making this up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that line. It's like, you know, history's Victor's right to history, and you guys don't seem to be winning.
Yeah.
So, like, I think he definitely had their attention, but I wish there was just a little bit something more, though, so I don't think that these Anacreons and Thespians are credulous idiots.
There's something besides
the word of Hollow Harry that they lean in, because the real politic of this makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, like, there's definitely a theory. There's a motive. There's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Cleon, like, he, like, you know, you got this guy who thinks generationally, and he sees this powerful thing aligning against it, and, like, he can find an easy way to split it up. Like, that all makes sense. I just think that there needed to be, I wish there was a little bit of, like, a hint of, and it didn't need, it just literally need to be like, if you check this optical wafer, you can verify. See all my research.
I agree. I think it almost gets there, because Rowan, I think at this point, wants to believe something that can give them a future again, he'll be a sucker for anybody at this point, right? Like,
yeah, because he wants a next step, like he says.
And I'm glad they have that scene later to kind of retroactively explain why he might have wanted to go along with this. They needed just something a little bit more there.
And I think most people that are into this story are, like, not going to care. They're going to be like, because, yeah, I'm asking for, but, like, I do think that there's some people who are on the borderline of, like, you know, this is just too weird, or it's too, or, like, there might be too many shortcuts. And I think stuff like this because this is a big episode. This is going to be for some people who are on the fence and kind of waiting to see what's in the vault. This might be a make or break where it's like, are they going to come back for season two or not? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I feel like, If you believe what I've, you know, like, we, this is unverified information, but
I want to see the wafer. I want to verify.
Yeah, I need to see the optical wafer on this. But we had someone that purported to be working for one of the organizations that monitors this stuff, and said that, like, there is a surprising number of people you know, on the order of millions of people. In fact, I listened to that Sean Carroll podcast, and Goyer intimated that there's millions of people watching this weekly. So this has found an audience. And I think that, like, for the majority of those people, especially when you're talking about people who are not diehard Asimov fans who have like a massive axe to grind about any little change, like there's that this brought the bacon home. This brought the goods home, whatever.
Yeah.
But I do think there is that other audience of maybe not diehard Asimov people, but like, you know, if you want to, maybe I was kind of like, I'm not sure if this is. That stuff like that might have them go, ah, but I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know how you can go, ah, after the Empire scenes in this, because they're so freaking good. Like, this is the stuff I loved about Game of Thrones, for instance. And some stuff about, like, Breaking Bad, too, right? Using what we know about characters in interesting ways that cause problems for other characters or dilemmas for other characters. I love that stuff, and we get a lot of it here. I was also noticing in this scene, Salvor noticing Harry and his diplomatic skills. And when we got to the part where she's talking about, oh, you're going to become mayor of Terminus, I'm like, okay, this makes sense. Like, in the book, she is this very, or he is this very contemplative character who's very good at diplomacy, and this must be where he or in the show's case, she picked that up. And then they just flip that on its head, because I don't know what she's not mayor. She's not mayor of anything. She's mayor of Watertown, as best I can tell.
Yeah. She popsicled herself and went to Watertown.
Yeah. So I don't know. But she was definitely like looking at Harry, kind of observing how he was interacting with the Anacreons and the Thespians.
Let me ask you a question, because I was curious. Mm-hmm. You were a lot more Invictus skeptic than I was. Like, you were like, the idea that Harry had tracked Invictus and all that stuff, you were like, I don't know. And I'm like, what did you, were you satisfied with Harry's explanation?
And the explanation being what? That he punched in the probability of the Invictus. He knew that the Invictus was out there somewhere. And that he could say, if it were to appear to the Anacreons, this is how things would go. And so he's calling audibles as he goes. Is that sort of the explanation?
No, I think that he said that, like, so obviously psychohistory is his magnum opus, but he didn't start off like as an 18-year-old, you know, freshman at Galactic U, like fucking psychohistory. He was working on many predictive models. And he said, that's what I've built my life's work on, finding patterns in what is apparent chaos. So he's saying that what the Anacreons were saying about the ship, that it's just randomly jumping. It's kind of like, you know, like there's the theory of like if you like pi apparently doesn't seem to repeat, you know, 3.14, blah, 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 blah. But like it might if you keep on calculating. So like the idea that like with sufficiently powerful calculations and predictive that you could pinpoint and that this is something that he could. I thought it was a little bit stronger, the fact that like he's just saying they're explicitly saying it's not chaos and only me with my advanced predictive. It's not psychohistory.
Yeah.
It's just his advanced predictive methods that he later applied to psychohistory were able to find an actual pattern to these jumps rather than what it appeared to be random chaos. So
if
he was able to predict its next few jumps and know when the Anacreons would discover it.
Yeah. If I were playing Magic the Gathering right now, I would say I'll allow it. I'm still sort of like side-eyeing that concept, but okay, sure.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm officially fine with it. I'm the DCI. I'm judge. I'm coming over here and be like, yeah. It's legal fine. Move. It's legal. It's a legal play. Yeah.
All right. To each their own. Let's move on to the next scene. Dusk and Day briefly talk about the trouble with Dawn, and it's obvious to Dusk that they have to kill Dawn and replace him with his clone.
And I just, you know, I don't know that much to say here, but like, I love the fact that they introduced the clone tanks and all that kind of stuff. And like, cause it's so fucking menacing that they're debating about what to do in front of like the hot swappable spare.
Yeah. That's
it's
a great
like
setting.
When my 2 terabyte drive goes out and starts blinking red in my NAS and I'm sitting here like, oh, I wonder if I should break the mirror and replace the set. Like, it's only human beings. I thought that was, and they don't, you know, like since they've established all this, all that weight comes into these scenes for free. And I think that's a mark of good entertainment when everything, all the layers are appreciated as they are laid down, but then they overlap and reinforce in really great ways. And this scene is one of the, you know, like, again, they get all this for free. They get all this like drama and tension just because of the concepts they've established.
I feel like this whole episode is a masterclass in that it's using what has come before in layered ways that make the next scene even more interesting. And we'll talk about it when we get there, because there are two scenes with Empire that I'm itching to fucking talk about.
And also I loved how, cause like we were talking about like, oh, maybe Day will rebel against Dusk and want to keep Day Dawn. And I'm like, fuck yeah, that prediction's looking really good until it didn't. Cause like they had set up enough animosity and enmity and like, fuck you, old man. You got us into this position.
You were right. And you were absolutely right. I mean, it's only by Demerzel's decision here that doesn't come true, right? Like, Day was ready
to Empress, the true, we are living, all along, we've lived in a matriarchal society. They've been the empire, it's the Empress Demerzel, first of her kind.
The true power has stepped out from behind the curtain. Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Dude. I mean, it's open and shut. And none of those boys did a damn thing against it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. Let's first talk about the scene where Day talks to Dawn in private, and Dawn says he's known for a long time that he wasn't like Day, but he wanted to be, and he was studying him. He was studying hollows of him, you know, how he picks up his forks and drinks his wine, all that. And then Dawn delivers this impassioned plea, I guess, to the part of Day that craves individuality that he thinks exists within Day. And it doesn't really seem to work in this scene. You know, Day plays it off, but
they put there's a couple things they do here. Cause they've all been brother. But I think we've said in several podcasts, like there is twinges of father, son, there is twinges of grandfather, father. There has to be, right? There just has to be, you know? And I felt like they kept on, you know, this wasn't so much a little brother pleading with his big brother to cover me in front of mom and dad. It's more of like a son being like, why are you disappointed in me? Because all I've ever wanted to be is you. And yeah, I've fallen short, but like, haven't you, you know, kind of like, yeah, I'm an aberrant clone, but you've had the feel.
You're more like me than you admit. Yeah.
Yeah. And like this whole like, haven't you ever felt stifled? Haven't you wanted to be more than just an installment, like an individuality? Mm-hmm. I thought that stuff like I am maybe the thing you want to be, a break out of the mold. And that stuff, I think, all work because they've been building these themes carefully for several episodes.
Absolutely. And the other thing they do here is they use language very carefully. When Dawn is making his plea today, he says, we're just echoes of this old of Cleon the First, which echoes back to Halima telling him you're just an echo of some man's ego, right? So they're layering in, right? And that hits him. It does. You can see it on his face. And yeah, that stuff is really good.
And like, yeah, like a perfect copy of an echo or a corrupted echo, their destiny is to fade out over time.
Right.
Which is how Dawn thinks about it. And you can, cause like, you know, it was a little bit sharp of a curve to go from, because I was really looking forward to fucking damnation and hell day coming down and just like tearing strips at his boy, you know, essentially giving him the Azura treatment, right?
Or
like,
the mathematician. Kind of
what kind of fucked up thing will Empire do with all of his thoughts bent to torturing somebody, right? And we got the answer to that. Not to the target I thought we'd get, but we got the answer to that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know about like, I advocated for it, but I don't know about Day just like, yeah, this is cool, I love you, son, it's okay. But they had done just enough where it's like that experience he had on the maiden wasn't all bullshit.
No.
The ultimate thing he did was bullshit. Mm-hmm. But like, he did have an experience of being a common man and finding commonality with another pilgrim and kind of like marveling at the heroicism of this man's faith, or like the totality of it, how explicit it was.
Yeah.
And that stuff all kind of went into the gumbo of this episode and made everything a lot more flavorful, I thought.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to Harry continuing to explain the true purpose of all of his machinations is not to preserve knowledge, but rather to gather together the people required to create a new society. Everyone's worried about the wrath of the Empire, so Harry tells them we're going to create a mega flare with the Invictus, which will trick the Empire into thinking everyone on Termas is dead. And the kids ask him if he's a ghost. He explains, you know, how the coffin broke him down and turned him into the vault. And then he warns them war with the Empire is inevitable, but they have time to prepare for it. And then he's, as he's walking away, Salvor wants information about her visions, and she goes up and asks him about it, and he's like, never heard of it. Never heard of you. I don't know about these visions. And then just walks back into the vault.
As far as the like internal like structures rhyming, like you said, the echo versus echo, like this is the scene, back-to-back scenes talking about stifling. And I like how, you know, a lot of times when we talk about fucked up systems, like, you know, when we're talking about the patriarchy that we live in, right? You know, like it's all this and that about the patriarchy, and it's usually about the damage it does to women, right? But like the reality is the patriarchy does a lot of damage to the men too. Like we're emotionally stunted, we don't live full expressive creative lives, we don't have nearly the intense, like, you know, bonds between our fellow men that we had just, you know, a few hundred years ago, right? It cuts it, the damage cuts both ways. And I thought that this was interesting that like Harry's talking from a, the whole galaxy's being stifled, right? Like you had this whole chorus of voices and it's stifled in favor of one. But we just saw in the previous scene that like this isn't a system that works for the Kleon clones either.
Yeah.
Because they're not. They've invented a fucked up dictatorship that no one has a say.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a self-proposed. And I like that, where it's a critique of the system, not just from the outside, but also internally, that like this is going to fail, not just because of efforts from without, but from within. It's also rotten and corrupt, or been corrupted. And not just, I don't think from like, oh, rebels went and fucked with your DNA. It's just kind of, it almost feels in retrospect amazing it lasted for 14 generations, or I just gotta get, you know, continue to last, I guess.
Almost seems like a bad idea from the jump. Yeah.
What do you think of this mega flare deal? I feel like I understand it, but like they really lightly touched on it, and I think some fans might be confused about what the hell they're suggesting here.
I think the idea is they're going to use the jump drive on the Invictus to make it appear as if the star has gone supernova or whatever. They call it a mega flare. You know, just sends out enough radiation to kill everything in the system, I guess. And so the Empire will think everyone there is dead. We are not going to bother.
Yeah, like, you know, when you on Earth, we have these things called coronal mass ejections where like every once in a while the sun just throws a piece of itself off. And if Earth is lined up there just right, it, you know, could fry all of our communication systems. It could do a lot of bad shit. But I suppose if the magnetosphere was weak enough or the sun was strong enough that like something like that could sterilize a planet. And I think that's what they're saying, that like the Invictus jump drive firing up behind the sun is going to look like the sun is. Now, I don't know, knowing the Empire, like I would love to see Harry's probability ratings on this of like Brother 50-50. Dawn. Yeah, Brother Dust showing up just to gloat. Like, I want to see the burnt husk of Terminus, that fucker. It's all done. Like, they're just like, I don't know what the probabilities of that are, but apparently he's pretty confident that the Empire is just going to there's no way they could have a jump drive, and the only thing this could be is a coronal or, you know, mega flare. So they're just dead, and we don't got the time to fucking go out there and check it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm willing to give it to
all him. Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So here's what I think is maybe the second, but perhaps the best scene in the episode. I don't know. So Day goes to see Azura, who's being held captive. He invites her on a walk in the garden, and he explains to her the burden of how does he express it? The burden of not being allowed to carry a burden is kind of how he expresses it, or not being able to prevent individual suffering in favor of, you know, greater prosperity. And he tells her that his hope for his legacy is to be the same as every other Kleon, and that Dawn will be the same, and that she has robbed him of that legacy by tainting Brother Dawn. So in return, he has traced her lineage back to her great-great-grandparents and taken all of those people, everyone who ever descended from them, 712 in total, as well as her present and former friends, her lovers, her teachers, her co-workers, even in the palace, their parents and siblings, 839 of them in total. And when he gives the signal, they'll all be executed. And he gives that signal right there in front of her. And then he has her put into total isolation, where she will be kept alive to live out her days without any sensory input. This is about as fucked up of a punishment as I can imagine.
Yeah, I can't. When I was younger, I read a Tom Clancy book, Cardinal in the Kremlin, and he postulated this Soviet-style technique of interrogating people, where they would essentially put them in a sensory deprivation tank. It's warmed up to your body temperature. Put a, you know, like a, feed you oxygen and food through an intravenous tube, and then put you in this suspension, kind of like to wear, and put you in like a some kind of stiff rubber suit where you couldn't like move your, but it didn't feel like you were being restrained. And like, no one lasted more than 8 hours before they would do or say anything to get out of that.
Yeah.
I don't even know what a person would look like after, like, she, Lazura looks like she's fairly young. I don't know what it looks like to spend like 70 years in this kind of isolation, like to be kind of Metallica's one. Also with the last, to have a, just to go into that with this massive crushing defeat that you thought you were on the cusp of a beginning of a victory, and it just all turns to ash. And
everyone you've ever known killed, everyone, like everyone you've ever known, like, and it, mostly everyone who's ever known them. It's
this is what the Warhammer fans coined the word grimdark for. It's a type of horror that we couldn't even do today. Like, and the thing is, you know, the Empire's not lying. Like, if, you know, some guy went to this in 21st century, and like, if the President of the United States had said he's got this and he's got like, you know, 1600 Navy SEALs with sniper rifle, you'd be like, fuck you, whatever.
Right.
Maybe you got my immediate family, but we have no doubt the Empire has the ability and the power to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And when he turns those fingers around, which I just noticed for this is like, he's literally inverting his blessing. You know, when he that's his sign for like the Anacreons and the Thespians. Like, it's like the, you know, respect and enjoy the peace, but fuck, you know, like,
it's no, that's it's great. I didn't get that layer, but there are so many layers in this scene, because like what he's doing, the isolation that he's imposing on her for the next X amount of years is exactly what Harry Seldon was talking about driving a mind mad earlier in the episode, right? He said, of course, I can't be alive. I can't be sentient in this vault. That's insane.
Dude, yeah.
You know, stronger men than I have tried it, and they've been reduced to mumbling whatever. So yeah, I think like that layering is so good. And then this scene, I want to talk about it in a pair with the scene where Demerzel makes the choice of Empire over any individual Cleon, because they're so closely intertwined. This scene where he's telling, where he's telling Azura about like his legacy, and how like she's taken that from him, and telling her about like, I have to think of the bigger picture, right? I don't have the luxury of being burdened by the suffering of individuals. Then plays immediately into that other scene, because Demerzel is taking that action and causing him the individual suffering for the greater good of the Empire. It's just such a perfect combination of scenes.
And we talk about like, you know, Goyer setting up some of these shots, like maybe you could say it's a little bacon gauntlety, a little ham fisted, but I really like the pitcher plant, the spider web, the fact that Azura like is walking into, you don't know what it is because it's her garden. It's where she probably feels very comfortable, very safe, but she is walking into a trap that there is no escape from. Yeah. Like, she's like a fly that steps on those slippery petals in the pitcher plant. She's fucked. I love like some of the way this thing is shot. Like, it was shot like a mix of like intimate, like very tight shots of Azura's face and Day's face, but also at removes that kind of made you feel I think it's intended to kind of symbolize days of detachment from the misery and suffering that he's inflicting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final shot, like the drone shot of the garden. And yeah. I a couple things struck me. Number one, it looks shockingly like the logo for this podcast.
Okay. It does.
Number two, the Trantor is always called the Eye of the Emperor, right?
Mm.
The Eye of the Empire. And like what it there's like a line in the Bible about what a fear inspiring thing it is to fall into the hands of the living God, because it's like, yeah, you know, if you're Christian, that's that may be comforting. But on the other hand, like this is a vast, powerful thing, and it's focused. It's all of its attention on you, maybe for salvation, maybe for damnation. Yeah. But here the Eye of the Empire is focused on one single person to their utter destruction as an individual. And I think, and it's like, it also like felt like the center of the spider web, like all that stuff just came together on a visual level. Mm-hmm. And I found it very, very satisfying. The last feedback episode, we were talking about the concept of, you know, what would it look like if we, you know, they set up the idea of like multiple jumps causing progressive damage. And like, if they're ever going to be a character that has gone through multiple jumps and like what they would look like.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder like if there's going to be a scene 30 years into the future from this scene where Empire is like, you know, maybe their palace is being breached and they rescue Azura. What is a person look like? What a great villain, yeah. Right? Like that's like the Joker, you know, like as someone that's been like they're and maybe they're not conventionally crazy, but they are, whatever they are is not fully human.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like, that's such a great concept. I feel like that they got to explore it because I want to see warped inhuman Azura.
Yeah. I want to just see her cut holes into that isolation mask and that be like her new supervillain costume.
She's like Bane.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she's like wearing a luchador mask or something. Right. Sure. Yeah, like the Unshrouded. Or like collar.
In Game of Thrones, who was that weird Dornish dude with like the faceted golden mask? I can't remember the name of it, but yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Okay, let me set up this second scene real quick. We're going to jump ahead a little bit, but it's all worth it. So Demerzel escorts Dawn to the throne room. I don't know where he's going to face off with the other Cleons. She claims she doesn't hate him on the way there. And then when he gets there, Dusk declares his contempt for Dawn. Day talks about the journey that he's been on and says that a dynasty cannot bend will inevitably break. And then he decides they must bend a little bit here. And so he says, Dawn can live. Dusk loses his shit and just begins shouting, begins pushing and shoving and slapping Day. And Dawn runs over to Demerzel for protection. And while these boys are fighting in the yard, Dawn makes the executive decision to snap his neck. She makes the call here. This is amazing. Like, the balance of power, you always felt like it was in Day's hands, right? He's the middle seat. He's the one who gets to actually make the calls for 30 years or whatever until he ages out. No, we see, in fact, the true power is actually not on the throne. It's with Demerzel. Because I don't think either of these guys can take her. She's a robot. I don't care how ripped and cut and stacked you are. Lee Pace is not going to be able to take her out.
It would also be extremely interesting to see, like, if they ordered their Imperial stormtroopers to assault her, what would happen? Because, like, the thing is, yeah, like, no one was in that room. Like, it was just Demerzel and the three of them. So, like, I wonder what if they would, like, ordered guards to come in to restrain her or something, what would have happened? Because the thing is like, that scene where Cleon the First is talking to Demerzel and says, you know, like, I'm loyal. She says, I'm loyal to Empire. And Cleon the First says, but will Empire be loyal to you?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Demerzel's supremacy is woven very deep in the fabric of this genetic dynasty, to the extent that, like, so, I would love to see what would happen. You know, we saw, like, the Shadow Master wasn't having Dawn boss him around, like, nah, buddy, it's time. We all serve. Yeah, you're Empire, but we all serve. Like, mm-hmm. I think there might be, like, some kind of execute Order 66 shit that's, like, plugged into all, like, you know, like, maybe they're physically incapable of.
I think, like, at the very least,
all systems programs happened in those last few months of Cleon's life, you know?
Yeah, we don't really know. I would say at the very least, I think Demerzel could justify fighting back to preserve her life, because what happens if she's gone? What happens with the clones, right? The clones is the dynasty. If she's not there to preserve it, what happens to it?
It's all about the conflict between the First and Second and Third and Zeroth laws. And, like, man, the people that thought that, like, they're not playing with this stuff.
This is the Zeroth law in action.
Well, not only that, but, like, I think by the end of this episode, Demerzel breaks all of the, well, except for the Zeroth law, perhaps, but she breaks every single one of the laws. She harms, you know, she disobeys an order from a human.
Mm-hmm.
She kills a human and allows a human to come to harm by direct inaction, and harms herself.
Yeah, pulls her face skin off. Yeah,
pulls her face right. This is if you don't see that this isn't a robot that's fully in psychosis over the multiple overlapping and conflicting overrides of it, then I don't know what the fuck to tell you. And it's fascinating, and it's very Asimovian, I think.
No, I agree. The other thing about this scene, I mean, I love the power shift here, and it has to be terrifying to the Cleons, I think, because of how that power just shifted on them. But also, Dawn telling Azura that he has to think about the bigger picture comes back into play here, right? Because, like I said, that's exactly what Demerzel does in this moment. She steps back, looks at the bigger picture, and causes him great suffering in the process. It's really just like a poetic twist here,
and it's such a great scene to watch, because you're like, you know, because Dawn flees to Demerzel and, like, buries his face in her chest and is like, don't let them kill me, don't, and she's like, hush, child, I'm not gonna, and you're thinking, like, she might mama bear the whole thing, and, like, but instead she's like, well, I won't let them kill you, I'll do it. And like the fact, and also one of the things that Dust said I thought was fascinating. He goes to Day and he's like, I'd rather decant one of you than like, does Dusk have ultimate authority over who is the Kleon and who is not? Because it'd also be interesting to see if Dimmerzell did a decision that neither of them supported, because Dusk clearly wanted this to happen and was in full support, and Day felt like the one down. But like, if both Dawn and Day, or Dusk and Day, or Dawn and Day, or Dawn and Dusk were united against Dimmerzell again, like, I wonder what would happen then. Maybe with the thing that like that's what tipped it into the balance or actuators or her logical things is the fact that like she did have the support of one of the Empire, but
maybe
it's just again great. Like, I got something new out of every single time I watched it, and like more facets and more facets.
Yeah, there's one other cute little thing they do here. Dave's talking about, you know, an Empire that doesn't bend is destined to break. Maybe we need to bend a little here, and Dimmerzell guarantees that the Empire doesn't bend with a break of this kid's neck. I kind of like that detail.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also a lot of callbacks, like Dawn kind of hesitates before going into the Chamber of Judgment, and Dimmerzell with the iron bar right there at the small of his back.
Like Brother Darkness shuffling him
off.
The
second time I watched that, it started to imply that like she knew what was going to happen the second it happened.
Yeah, she was either going to make it happen or Day was going to do it.
Day was going to do the quote unquote right thing. And I think any debate about whether Darkness could be like, you know, at the last minute, like, ah, fuck this. Like, nah, it's done. Like, the Dimmerzell is that's the bar going down over your lap on the roller coaster, and you're going down that hill, man.
Yep. They're not stopping it.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. Okay. Let's jump back to,
138 years ago in the Outer Drift.
What? No. We have to. We skipped a bunch of.
I was introducing the character of time into our podcast.
Gotcha. We're not ready for them yet. Mari is annoyed that Harry lied to them. Salvor is doubly annoyed because she thought she was special, and now she has no idea where her visions are coming from. Her mom tells her that she is special, and that she just has to make her own plan now. Which should be liberating, I would think.
And the thing that you got to keep in mind is whatever reaction the Terminus folk are having to this and their ambivalence and whatnot, and the fact that they're like feeling they're used. You have to remember that this is all an effect that Harry both anticipates and is curating himself.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't like, oh shit, it's going to fly off the rails because, you know, Harry lied to these people and he didn't. I think you got to trust that, like, this is all part of the plan, as crazy as it seems, that like this kind of level of alienation and feeling like they wasted the life or what, like that this is something that he wanted to do. And also it's a rug pull that happens in the books, like this, the Galactic Encyclopedia being a bit of a misdirection is a plot line right from the books. And I thought it was executed very well, but it also like. Man, I gotta keep reminding myself of how next level Harry is, because like, you know, when we get to the end of this episode, like if he's intended all of this stuff and influenced all this stuff and this is the way it's going to go, like, oh man, that's a crazy thought for me.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that some more. I like that.
He definitely intended
up
all of this.
Yeah. And I like that it opens up possibilities. It frees them from the burden of having to think, what would Harry Seldon do? In a way, right? Now their only task is to build a society that they want to see themselves in. You know, it's not necessarily we have to anticipate what Harry was thinking at all times and how would he react. No. The Lewis is gone from this equation now.
Exactly.
And I like that.
It's time to come up with our own plan, which was still the plan that Harry had.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a plan that Harry imagines.
But it'll be there.
Taylor's.
It'll be their idea and they'll organically execute it. But it's still the Seldon plan. Yeah.
Yeah. But maybe without like what would Harry do in mind. I like that. All right. Rowan is planting an Anacreon tree near Ferris' body. And he tells Salvor that she was right about the future of Anacreon. And then gives her Farrah's bow and asks her to help him water the tree I think both metaphorically and physically.
Yeah, this is a this is a scene that's good because it explains why it's almost like you couldn't do it because like they'd have to solve their own crisis, right? But it's almost like you almost feel like I wish Salver had been the one to broker peace and that this scene preceded Harry coming and basically saying now that you because because this feels natural. This feels like this feels like an arc that this guy was on, and maybe Harry goosed him along a little bit. But I like it. They did. I don't know if this is a typo or I missed something, but like he mentioned, this bow was offered to the Empire over a century ago in peace. I don't think that timeline tracks.
No, I thought we were like 35.
The current day was a little boy when the but like you know a generation ago maybe. But I thought he said century, and or maybe the other thing is like I meant to I earmarked it, but I didn't have time to go back. I wanted to go back and watch that second episode. Was it first episode, second episode, where they're talking about the bow because it might have been like a previous gift to a previous emperor.
Could have been.
And they were like doing this as kind of like a store. So like there might be a way to square that circle, but I that was one kind of like question mark I had. Like where did this timeline come from?
Yeah. And then the tree grows, as does Terminus. It's the timing is a little weird here. I don't know how fast this tree grows, but all of this seems to happen in the span of maybe a couple of years, if that. And this tree grows huge. I think it's more of a metaphor. I think this is, you know, the watering of the tree is them planting a future for themselves. Yeah. But they represent it visually.
This is a cooperation montage. Yeah. I think I heard 18 months is how long it would take to get the Invictus repaired and ready to operate.
That sounds
and
about
obviously
right.
They also Polly, like if it's 5 years later, he would be a different looking kid. So we know it's not that long.
So everybody teams up to build a bunch of stuff. Hugo is the captain of the Invictus now. They generated the Mega Flare. Hugo returns from space with Polly. Seems like they can jump anywhere they want to go now with the Invictus. Mm-hmm. And Salvor and Hugo use his time on Terminus to get busy again in their sex shack. It's what they do.
You know? Align the telescope. Yeah.
Right? Do they just have a sex shack out in the middle of nowhere?
I think that's Salver's that she lives
her
apart
sex
from
shack.
Everyone.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's her Salver shack, but yes, it's primarily used for sex.
It doubles as a love shack. Salver sees a vision of Gale and wanders.
No word on the status of its tin roof and whether it's rusted or not.
Oh, should I understand that?
It's a love shack reference.
Oh, yeah. I know the title, not
B-52s,
the song.
B-52s, baby.
Salvor sees a vision of Gale and wanders off to the vault. This is all very reminiscent of the early stuff with her and Hugo, right? The first time we meet them, he comes back, she bangs him, and then she has a dream and she runs off and sees the kid in the ship.
He knocks a vision loose out of her. Yeah.
She finds a young Gale running toward the vault, and then that Gale dives into the dirt. And Salvor approaches the vault and wonders who gave her these visions.
Yeah, I mean, this is Luke Skywalker on Tatooine. Like, this is like another one of these great space porn shots. It's like extended, you know, of her on the ridge reaching up to the vault, and the vault's huge and glowing. And it gives you that sense of awe and wonder that you want from a big science fiction epic, you know?
I got a different sense of wonder. My wonder was more focused on who is going to volunteer to navigate the Invictus. Because they make it clear that these are like burn out and fade away kind of things, right? This ship burns you out in a matter of months and you just die.
I'm going to guess that they retrofit because you have a jump drive engineer. Well, I guess he's dead, but presumably you had other jump drive engineers like that. Yeah. They could retrofit a modern navigation package that doesn't require, but they don't have spacers.
They don't. They
so
have to
I don't
knock
know
themselves
how.
Out and do the jump and then.
Yeah, I guess.
But
so.
You need
yeah,
a navigator.
But you need
it's
a navigator.
Art. Yeah.
Well, that's the grim dark, man. Like,
I don't know.
Navigators like rounds of ammunition, man. You load a clip in there and fire, forget. Like they're just smoking out their eye sockets and like, get another navigator. I don't know. Like if you had a whole bunch of Anacreons way ready to jump into the heart of a planet, so maybe a bunch of them sign up. I don't know. But yeah, that'd be a good question for Goyer. Like how they navigate this thing.
Uh-huh. That's probably the only question I had here. And then Salvor goes to her mother's house and they talk about her father for a bit, which was nice because we didn't really get an opportunity to do that earlier. And Salvor asks who the girl from the water planet is. Her mother tells her that woman is in fact your mother, your bio mother. Salvor says she has to leave right now to go find Gale. And Mari gives her the Prime Radiant to take back to Gale. And she goes to her ship in the middle of the night, trying to leave without saying goodbye to Hugo. He finds her, though.
Dick move.
Yep.
Dick move, Salvor.
And they say a tearful goodbye before she boards her ship and leaves.
Yeah.
This is the R plus S. No, the G plus S equals R coming together.
Yep.
Equals the other S? I don't fucking know. There's
everybody
initials.
With your, no more Galian heretics. No more hardened heretics. You gotta bow down unless you have some kind of crazy ass theory about how this could be wrong. Yeah, this is confirmation.
Yeah, we have an eyewitness, right? Her adoptive mother says, yeah, this is where you came from.
I think there's plenty of evidence, you know. But then again, I was convinced about Jon Snow's parentage around season 3. But I continued to get alternate theories right up until
they reveal it.
You know, main characters right up until like it was revealed. So like, yeah, you know, they only strung us along for one season, and I felt like it was a light string. Like, you know, this show was giving away the shop as far as this theory goes. Cool. Again, this one, the beautiful spaceborn of the beggar leaving Terminus, flying by the Invictus, like all that stuff was
the leap, as they say.
Great. The leap. Yeah, yeah.
That struck me during the scene that Salvor is not going to be the mayor. They talk about her potentially becoming the mayor, like the book, nope. Nope.
So
she's
close,
gone.
So close to getting parity there. So close to like seeing like I'm like I could instantly see season 2,
right?
And then like Brother Dusk throwing his palette against the Six Lizard mural. Everything, the sands just shifted, and it's like fucking blurry. I have no idea what's going to happen now.
Yeah, I like Hugo. He really traded up in his ships, right? He went from the beggar to Invictus. Yeah.
Even the name, you know, you park the beggar and you come out with Invictus. Like, yeah, hell yeah. Right. Hell yeah.
The other thing I like about this, or I thought was interesting, is that they've got Harry, like as close to a physical manifestation of Harry as you can get in terms of the vault, right? Outside the city. And they have the opportunity to sort of reconfigure the city. They show it happening. And yet they still build it around the statue of Harry. You're not going to take your city and start building it around Harry himself in the vault?
Well, I
they might think it's dangerous.
Like, it seemed I thought they were implying with the tree that was going to be the new town center because like stuff started spiraling out from that.
I don't see it.
And the people there were saying like, you know, oh, this terminus is a dusty frontier town. Not anymore. It's going to be a bustling spaceport. It's going to be building... Yeah. These Invictuses, which I don't know how that happens either. I guess it's all there. Like they introduced the mines. You got the technical know-how. You got the manpower. You got the mineral resources, the outer reach. Like I guess it's just one of those things where it's like, man, how does a place like Terminus bulk up to be able to build an Invictus like that? But space magic.
Sure. Are they trying to say that Harry is the tree around which this community is growing? Because if I recall, when they show the tree growing from above, that might be the location where Harry's statue is. I
don't think so. Really, like they showed, they established where they're making that thing, and it's like it looked like a not used part of town. You know, there was like nothing around it. Farrah's body was on the pier.
I'm talking about not a literal, but a figurative. Like they're clearly doing some metaphorical. Liberty stuff with the tree in the speed it's growing at. I thought maybe also the placement of the tree was something were riffing on.
Could be.
Maybe not. All right. Dusk ruins the raptor portion of the mural. I don't know if he ruins the whole mural or not. How far do you think that spreads?
Probably the whole raptor part, or is it he's going to have to repaint, and he's going to anyway, because like, what are you going to do? Like codify, but that's the thing is like, fuck it. Let's just move on to the next scene because like, it's like, I'm just going to step all over it.
Okay. Day gently places Don's body into the disintegration chamber and disposes of it. And as he mourns, the Shadow Master informs him that the rebels' plans are more extensive than they first believed. Apparently, Cleon the First DNA has been altered, assuring that future clones will no longer be pure copies, and even Day himself is likely adulterated. Or no, he is. They checked his DNA, right? He is adulterated.
Well,
and Dusk is being examined for aberrations.
There is wiggle room. He said probably yes, but like,
okay,
was that probably just because the Shadow Master is afraid to tell? Like, it seems likely. Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
And then the very end of that scene is Day smashing Cleon the First preservation container.
So I would normally say that Dusk would probably nuke this painting and do something like to celebrate the new dawn, you know, like it never happened, right?
Uh-huh.
But Demerzel's actions to the contrary, there's nothing they can do to stop this. It doesn't feel like unless Dusk is pure and they can get a good sample off that. And this is just a cliffhanger. It feels like the genetic dynasty is already over. And the only question is, you know, the interesting concept of Galactic Council, which I don't think they'd talked about before. So like there is another body that is sounds like it's a representative of all the planets with light, you know, that like maybe can hold the Emperor accountable to some extent or to some that like that there's a fear there that if they show weakness that they'll be snapped up. And I'm just shocked that we're already drifting away from the genetic dynasty at the end of season one. And I wonder if like it was Goyer, is Goyer like a Harry Seldon? And he's just like, I might have lied about that. Mm-hmm. Because like if there's ever a showrunner that could just like tell bald faced lies to their audience and like get away with it, it's Goyer. Because he's just doing a Harry Seldon plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. He needs us. We thought we were doing the one thing and secretly we're doing the other.
That you can't tell a lie to your audience. It's how you tell the lie to your audience. And I think,
so far, the lies have been better. Also, the truth better be better than the bullshit, because you can also get yourself in trouble with that. You know, if you tell your kid, hey, we're going to Disney World, and it turns out you're just going to McDonald's.
The dentist.
The dentist. Yeah. That's a dirty trick. We like to call that. I don't know. I just know that Lee Pace is super good. Again, this was a tough corner to go to, like full on Tinder with Dawn. And I think it mostly worked. Mm-hmm. Did you get the idea that like Day might have been borderline suicidal? Because boy, I don't know where the boundary between the zapper and the non-zap are. And I was like, oh shit, he might be committing suicide.
I did wonder that for a brief second, but I think like the magic of their technology makes this pretty much guaranteed that he doesn't have to worry about that, right? It can probably Dawn.
I wonder if there's a bit of an intentionality where like Dawn was suicidal, but like
but then they just replace him with a clone. Like, isn't it better for him anymore to continue on with the knowledge of this and without being decant?
Well, what's better and what you can do and what you can bear and what you can bear in a moment is is a lot of different. And the fact that they adulterated Cleon, like, good Lord, the palace security. Oh my, like Dusk is talking about like, good thing I was here and I put a stop to all this. You were fucking asleep at the switch, old man.
Yeah.
Is this an inside job? Is this Demerzel? And then like the last scene of, Cleon the 13th, I think, bashing the shit out of Cleon the First.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this leave the dynasty? Like, it feels like it's shattered. And is this going to be yet another, is Goyer fooling us by thinking that we're going to have Lee Pace throughout the rest of the series? Because, like, I don't know, if you're no longer clones, why are you looking like each other?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If I'm Dimmerzell, and let's say Dusky is tainted, my temptation here, or my thought here, is to go with the clone who mostly is go with the Cleon who's mostly on board with the legacy plan, and then just extract DNA from them and continue the dynasty. Like, get as close as you can to the original and go from there, because you can't get back to the original, apparently.
Yeah. And I guess I'm, but like, I don't know, like, that would be much religious and spiritual significance that even the Empire has invested in this, because clearly, sure, like, that react, I don't know what that reaction Dusk was having, but it wasn't a rational one to the fact that this kid's colorblind and it's got his thumbs on backwards, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like it was like an abomination. The blood is line is tainted. It's like, it's crazy, crazy boomer talk. He's spitting. So, but yeah, I just liked it. Like this Lee Pace is so good with like, dismissing his shadows. Oh, nothing else. As he calmly takes the candle and he blows it out and then just goes and bludgeons this. Like what a scene.
Yeah, no, it's wild.
And leaving the Dusk cliffhanger, like that there might be a way to salvage this thing, and we'll find out next season. Because, like, yeah, next season could be 138 years into the future. It could flashback. It could be, who knows?
And I kept thinking, as I was watching this episode, okay, this is the final scene, right? It's such a big moment. It's such a cool fucking thing to end on. This is the end. And it just kept going scene after scene that was, if not cooler than the last, at least as big, at least as swinging for the fences as the last.
Because when we got to Dimmerzell tearing her face off, I'm like, oh, here's where we're going to get the credits. And then it's like 138 years later in the Blue Drift. What? It was a little Return of the King-ish. And I don't mind the Return of the King. Like, we did a podcast earlier, and I'm like, fucking, like, if something's good, keep giving me more of it. So, like, but yeah, there was a lot of potential endings.
For sure,
this season.
That's just how good all of these final scenes are, right? It's not. I'm not saying I was looking at my watch. I'm just saying every one of these could have been a season ender. They were all so good. Let's talk about that. In her chambers, Dimmerzell tears away her skin.
I think we covered it in the big Cleon.
Yeah.
The breakaway, but yeah, she does. This is a robot stretched to the point where she might break.
Yeah, you get to see a little bit more of what's under there, right? She's got the Terminator human teeth kind of thing going
on.
I guess.
Pretty prototype Westworld robot.
Yeah, it's got like an Art Deco feel to it, though, right? Like it's a little brassier than you would expect of maybe a robot. But yeah, I thought it looked very cool.
I think she looks great for her age. She's over 11,000 years old, and you know, the shit's still shiny under there. What more can you ask for?
True. Eat your heart out, Yoda. All right. In the Blue Drift, 138 years later, Gale wakes up as her pod descends onto Synax. She splashes down onto a world entirely covered in water. So, you know, science was right. Big surprise. She inflates a boat and takes Raish's knife on a journey to find signs of life. She finds her former home submerged, and she sees a beacon below the surface, dives down to investigate. She finds another pod. She opens it up to find a slumbering Salvor. She drags Salvor to the surface and revives her. And Salvor tells Gale she's her daughter and gives her the Prime Radiant as proof. This is the wafer, right? Like, hey, I've got this. Nobody else is going to have this thing.
Yeah, this is a mega wafer.
Yeah,
this is the Omega wafer.
I love what they do here. They do it a couple of times in the episode. They tease you, because there's the scene where Dimmerzell leads Dawn into the throne room to be judged, and you're not quite sure if there's another Dawn already sitting on the throne, because they don't show the left hand side. They use her to block it. They cut the shot a little off to the left. And in this scene, they're doing that with the land, right? I'm thinking, okay, did Synax survive? Is there new signs of hope on Synax? And you keep seeing the ship from below as it's descending, and they just won't show me. They'll rotate the camera almost to the land or to the horizon and then cut away. I just really appreciated them teasing that reveal.
Yeah, I also wonder, because like her home looks like it's like flooded up to the rafters, so that's like another 20-30 feet maybe. But on the other hand, her folks are planning on putting that up on higher stilts, so like who knows how much the water. And right. Also makes me wonder, like, what is left? Is there anyone left on this planet, or has this planet just been like abandoned? Mm-hmm. But when she looked at that knife, I thought she might throw it overboard. Yeah. And if though, I was like, what the hell? You know, that's another copy of Harry. But
well, this is for sure a way to get somebody back on board with the Foundation. Send them your daughter from the future back with the Prime Radiant with the keys, dude, to psycho history, and strand these two people together on this planet.
And the thing is like, this has got to be something that's in opposition of Harry. Unless Harry's lying again and knew about Gale's being a telepath or whatever, which that honestly opens up a big can of worms. Like, there's so many. All I see is cans of worms that are unopened with this particular plot line, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just like, yeah. But the one thing I was surprised, because I was like, when I saw there was this Salver in there, I'm like, oh, what the fuck? But she can access her mom's ancestral memories. And when she says, I have a hunch about where she's going, that means a hell of a lot more than it does from most people. You know, and so she's like, now I don't know how she crashed. The circumstances as she gets there is kind of wild. And I wonder if they'll rewind the clock a little bit and we'll get a little bit more of that next season. But like, yeah, I really wonder where they're going. Cause like one thing I don't believe is that Harry intended his dagger and him and Gale and Salvor to be on Synax on this water planet 138 years in the future. Like there'll be a lot of exposition and script to get me onto that, but like it just seems like it boggles my mind about how, again, the question is how next level is Harry. And right. They can make him however next level they want, but they do have to kind of walk us through how he got there. And right now, everything he's saying is this is a surprise, even affirming when he comes out the independent copy of him on Terminus that comes out and is like, where's Gale? Fuck, Gale's not here. Like, why would he say that if I don't know?
Part of a subterfuge.
I don't know. I guess you can always just say Harry's a fucking liar.
Sure. The other thing that struck me, because this is all being done sort of underneath the narration by Gale, who's talking about the leaps, you know, and sometimes someone catches you. And I thought about like the leap that Salvor is taking in this to strand herself on this planet where she thinks Gale might be for 138 years, for presumably as long as that pod will keep her alive, right? Like, she's not coming out of that at any point unless somebody else brings her out of it.
On the other hand, I do think those pods can, like, you know, like they lasted for like what, 38 years, and then was able to, without being refueled, blast off and go to a system 138 years away. So like, again, magic technology. I think,
oh no, but it's a leap to assume that anyone will ever find you. You might be down there for 4,000 years.
It is a leap at this intuition, right? Like, if she sees her mother going back to Synax, then you're right. It's a leap, but I think she has an enormous. I mean, part of this whole season arc is Salver having faith in herself.
Yeah.
You know, trust your instincts, trust your instincts, trust your instincts, open your fist, trust your. And she's doing that now. I mean, this is a ballsy. Yeah. This is a ballsy play.
And I think that's why it's so nice to have this narration at the end, because, yeah, it does nicely tie off both of these things. Or describe both of those things.
I have three things to talk about random on this scene.
Okay.
It honestly took me aback that parachutes deployed. Right?
Yeah, like, they seem not futuristic
like
enough.
Fucking Apollo era? Like, they're just like fucking like, really? Not anti-grav, not repulsors, not even fucking Elon Musk technology, just parachutes. I mean, if it ain't broke, if it ain't broke, then, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Also, like, I'm certain this is the screener nature of it, but when I can only describe it as an unfinished effect we saw of that transparent kayak deploying. I'm sure there's no way that's the final. I mean,
I'll describe it. It's like a tan previs looking
It's not textured. Not textured. It's transparent.
It's all blocky. Yeah, it was.
It's a kayak made of marmalade. Is what it looks like.
Yeah.
And then it turns into the clear thing. Also, that clear kayak handled like shit.
Uh-huh.
I felt sorry for the Akka's like it. It is not track. It is not like she puts a pin and like gives and it just like almost spins 180.
It's coated
like,
in Teflon looked, on the bottom.
it looked like a real handful to paddle on very, very what I'm sure is earth water. I don't think they actually went to Synax for this. So but that's what happens when you design something to look futuristic and awesome and probably didn't get into the water until you started filming.
Yeah,
but I thought it was really because I'm a kayaker myself, and I just thought it was hilarious. The first paddle she takes is like, whoa, goes 90 degrees. Next paddle, whoa, 180 in the other direction.
It's like, you know, those sleds when you were a kid that were just dishes, like slightly curved dishes.
The round ones. Uh-huh,
that's like what she was trying to kayak in. Spinning 360.
You
with
can
every
make
stroke.
Suggestions of which direction to go, but ultimately.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, that's it. That's all I got.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see what you all thought of this episode, and you can satisfy my curiosity by sending an email to foundation@baldmove.com. At the time of this recording, we haven't confirmed anything with Goyer as far as like a follow-up conversation at the end of the season, but I would, if you do have some questions for him and we do are able to catch up with him, it's complicated. It's going to be Thanksgiving pretty soon, then Christmas, who knows?
Yeah.
But if you want to take that leap of faith, you want to throw the message in the bottle and see if anyone responds, make sure you put Goyer in the subject matter line, because I'm going to try to, you know, net all those up when I'm compiling, you know, potential questions to ask for him. And again, I'm not promising this because we haven't heard back. But if so, you know, by the next time we talk to you, it'll be too late to get them in. So go ahead and send those in. And also foundation@baldmove.com is where you send them. Goyer in the subject line if you got a Goyer question, else just give us the feedback. And we'll be back in a couple of days to do feedback and do wrap up and maybe come back with another Goyer episode. But if not, we'll see you in a couple of days for the feedback. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.